The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, we have David Grimm, online news editor of Science, here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. I'm Isabel Bunny. So, David, the researchers in our first study for today were studying chimpanzees and found a wide range of intelligence levels. What did they make of this?
Well, Isabel, we know obviously in human society that we have a pretty wide range of intelligence. There are some of us that are maybe not so bright. And then, of course, we've got individuals like Tesla and Einstein that are really sort of at the top of the heap. And the question is, do other animals sort of show the same range of intelligence that we do? And to do this today, the researchers actually looked at a group of chimpanzees, some of whom lived in sanctuaries in Africa, others that lived in a zoo, others that lived in captivity in Germany. And they really sort of, they tested them on a lot of different tests. In one experiment, they asked the chimpanzees to find food in a container after it had sort of been shuffled around with empty containers. In another experiment, the chimpanzees had to use a stick to get food placed on a high platform. So sort of test to see whether they could sort of intuit how to figure out different situations. And what they saw is sort of something that you'd probably see in humans too, was that there was a really big variation in how the chimps performed on these tests. Some of them did better on some of them did better on others. But there was one individual, this female chimp named Natasha, who really sort of blew all the other chimps away.
So you talked a little bit about the different sorts of tests administered to these apes. How reliable were individual intelligence tests? So how predictive of other measures of intelligence were they?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, humans, we have this IQ test, which is somewhat controversial, but people say, you know, the higher you score on this IQ test, the more intelligent you are. The researchers didn't really find that for the chimpanzees. They found that, you know, chimps performed well on one test, they didn't necessarily perform well on another. So there wasn't one test they could give them and say, this chimpanzee is smarter than this other chimpanzee. But with Natasha, she really excelled so much at all of the tests that the researchers could reliably say that, you know, if you want to use the word smart, she was sort of a lot smarter than all the other chimps. She was sort of the Einstein of the group.
What has this study taught us about intelligence in general?
Well, basically what it tells us is, first of all, that, you know, there is a range of intelligence in other animals, at least in chimpanzees, the same sort of range we see in humans. Although, obviously, chimpanzees aren't going to be necessarily good at the same things that we're good at. So just because we give a chimpanzee a math test doesn't mean that because the chimpanzee fails that test that the chimpanzee isn't smart, just because chimpanzees don't usually use math in their daily lives like we do. You know, the trick with trying to determine the intelligence of an individual is to try to design tests that are really specific to them, which is why the researchers had them doing tests where they were trying to find food or trying to sort of intuit where a treat might be, something analogous to something they might have to do in the wild.
From smart apes to hungry monkeys, our next study covers the effects of a special diet called calorie restriction on the health of rhesus macaques. But let's back up a bit. So what are some of the benefits for different species that have been found for this sort of diet?
Well, Isabel, there is something known as the calorie restriction hypothesis. And the idea is pretty simple. The less you eat, the longer you live. And it's actually been shown, as you alluded to, in a number of species, mice, some worms that are given a lot less to eat actually live a lot longer. But the findings haven't been replicated in humans, and it's been really hard to test this. These animals, like mice or worms, have lifespans of sometimes days, with mice maybe a few months or a couple years. So it's relatively easy to run experiments where you can look at the entire life of an animal and see, okay, if we fed this animal 25% less food, does it live, you know, maybe a few months longer? But humans obviously have such big lifespans, it would be really hard to do this study with people. So in this new study, they turned to rhesus monkeys, which are related to us, a lot more related at least than mice or worms are, but have a much shorter lifespan. The average lifespan for rhesus monkeys is about 27 years. And the results of the study with one group of monkeys came out in 2009, where researchers showed that monkeys living at the Wisconsin National Primate Research Center that ate a lot less than control monkeys seemed to live a lot longer. 13% of the calorie-restricted monkeys had died from old age versus 37% of the control animals. So there really seemed to be this sort of significant effect of calorie restriction.
So this study looked at two different groups of monkeys in Wisconsin and Maryland, respectively. Were there any differences found between the two groups?
Right. Well, there was another group of monkeys that was also being studied. This group lived at the National Institutes of Health Animal Center in Dickerson, Maryland. And the researchers conducted very similar experiments with these monkeys. They fed some of the monkeys a lot less than others. What was interesting about this study was in this study, the calorie-restricted monkeys did not seem to live longer. One similarity between the two studies is that in both the Maryland and the Wisconsin groups, the monkeys that ate less seemed to have a higher quality of life. They had less cardiovascular disease. They also had much less incidence of developing cancer. And that was also true of the Maryland group. So even though the Maryland calorie-restricted monkeys weren't living longer, they seemed to be living at least better than their counterparts that were eating a lot more calories.
Okay, so is there still room for optimism about potentially expanding longevity?
There is. And in fact, some experts point to some differences between these two studies. They say that the Wisconsin group of monkeys were actually not eating as healthy of a diet. And in fact, they were eating a diet that was high in processed food and refined sugar. And obviously, the monkeys that weren't calorie restricted were eating a lot more of this. And that could explain the differences in lifespan, whereas the Maryland monkeys were on a much healthier diet. So there could still be a cause for optimism. It could mean that in humans, it's not just sort of reducing the calories that we eat, but actually eating healthier food as well. Again, though, we're just talking about monkeys. These studies haven't really be done in humans, although there is a study that's currently ongoing that has tried calorie restriction in humans, and the results of that are actually going to be coming out pretty soon. So we should know in the fairly near future whether a calorie-restricted diet actually has benefits for humans in addition to the benefits it's already been shown to have for mice, worms, and monkeys.
Good to know. Now, this next study turned the tables on researchers, making them the subjects. So what was this study exactly about?
Well, this study is kind of a fun one. It's about what researchers' faculty webpages say about them. If you go to any university website and look for a scientist, chances are you'll not only see their bio and their CV on the page, but you'll also see a picture of them. It turns out there's some differences in pictures. Some faculty members tend to have their left cheek facing the camera. Some have their right cheek facing the camera. And this study was trying to figure out, is there any meaning behind that? Are these faculty members consciously or unconsciously presenting something about their personality to the rest of us?
So what is significant about the left side of the face?
Darwin postulated that emotions are stronger on the left side of the face. They actually sort of begin on the left side of the face, and they're actually expressed more on the left side of the face. So if somebody was unhappy, you maybe have a better time being able to register that by looking at their left side of their face than their right side. And actually, it sort of makes sense from a neuroscience point of view, because the nerves on the left side of the face are actually controlled by the right side of our brain, which has also been linked to the processing of facial expression. So it all sort of adds up to this idea that if you're looking at the left side of somebody's face, you're seeing sort of maybe more of their emotional side, whereas maybe if you're looking at the right side, you're seeing maybe more of their rational, non-emotional side.
So how did the researchers conduct their study to determine whether the left-facing bias was consistent or true?
Well, yeah, that was really the question. You know, do faculty present one side or the other of their face to the camera? And what does that say about how they want to be viewed by the world, either consciously or unconsciously? The idea would be that if a faculty member is presenting the left side of their face, maybe they want people to think they're more emotional, maybe more sensitive. And if they're presenting the right side of their face, maybe they want the public to think they're more calm, they're more rational, they're less emotional. They're more, as we say in our headline, a little bit more like Mr. Spock on Star Trek. And actually, that's what the researchers found. They scanned almost 6,000 faces from 30 university websites around the world, and they found that faculty members in the sciences, in engineering, and mathematics field were significantly more likely to show the left side of their face than the right side of their face in these faculty pictures, whereas their colleagues in the arts and humanities were statistically more likely to show the right side of their face, which again gets back to this idea that maybe faculty members want to show themselves as more cool and rational, and maybe the arts and humanities folks want to show themselves as more emotional.
So are there any unanswered questions left, or what further research should be done?
Well, one expert says that, you know, there's still really no evidence that just even if faculty members are purposely or unpurposely showing these different sides of their faces to the world, whether we're actually registering that as differences in their personality. In other words, if I see the faculty page of a scientist who's presenting her right cheek to the camera, do I automatically think, well, hey, she seems a lot more serious, a lot less emotional? Or is that just sort of a hypothesis on the part of these researchers and it's actually not really the case? So a little bit more research needs to be done to see not only how do faculty members present themselves to the world, but how do the rest of us actually react to the way that these people are facing the camera.
All right, David. Now, what are some of the other recent stories on our online daily news site?
Well, Isabel, for Science Now, we've got a story about using dogs to scare pigeons away on beaches and how that could improve public health. Also got a story about weighing individual molecules with a mechanically vibrating beam. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about how stem cell research is faring in U.S. courts. Also a story about how President Obama is interacting with science teachers across the country. Finally, we are back in business with Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. Next week's Science Live is going to be about the impact of brain injury on cognition and how that might play into sports and the military. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, Isabel.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news on the policy blog Science Insider at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.